This week, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a historic defense of abortion rights. This hour, two Iowa reactions to that ruling, one pleased, the other disappointed. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we hear from Maggie DeWitte of Iowans for Life and Mark Falkstrom of Planned Parenthood of the Heartland. Then, a black bear killed by a truck in northeast Iowa prompts us to ask about native Iowa species that have disappeared from the state. Following that, University of Iowa scientist Bob Kurth on the instrument his team has aboard the Juno mission, which is about to begin its orbit of Jupiter. And finally, after 6 dry years, Lake Delhi begins to refill. Buckle up for your news buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a historic defense of abortion rights. The 5-3 decision struck down parts of a Texas law. That law required clinics performing abortions to have surgical facilities and also required doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. Let's get two Iowa reactions to the ruling. In just a moment, we'll hear from Mark Falkstrom of Planned Parenthood of the Heartland. But first, let's talk with Maggie DeWitte, Executive Director for Iowans for Life. Maggie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So give us your reaction to the decision that came down on Monday.
Well, you know, a mix of reactions. Anger, being just not really understanding why we wouldn't want to pass something that would help women and would be about women's health. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me have you then react to the reasoning of the court in the majority opinion, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and others, citing the fact that abortions are statistically safer than many simpler medical procedures, tonsillectomies, colonoscopies, in-office dental surgery, even childbirth. But in this case, Texas did not subject those procedures to the same requirements, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, quoting her, given those realities, she wrote in her opinion, it is beyond rational belief that this law could genuinely protect the health of women and certain that the law would simply make it more difficult for them to obtain abortion. So that's the reasoning. And she's saying that under such circumstances, when you have fewer abortion providers, as is the case because of this law in Texas, that women may resort to unlicensed rogue practitioners, as Ginsburg wrote.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I would just have to respectfully disagree, obviously, with that analysis. You know, just yesterday, publication LifeSite News just publicized something that said, an article yesterday that I read that said nearly 1,000 Texas women are hospitalized every year from botched abortions. So when I read that headline and was reading more about the statistics and also hearing from some people like Abby Johnson, who was a former Planned Parenthood director for over 10 years, and she described how unregulated and in some cases unsanitary conditions that are happening within these abortion facilities. So the idea that we would not want more stringent or stricter or just basic, really, I mean, that's all we're really talking about. Mm-hmm. I mean, making hallways big enough so a gurney can get through if there was an emergency, making sure there's proper soap dispensers. I mean, we're just talking about not anything really extreme, but just some basic protocols. And then, you know, the other piece that I would talk about is what happened here recently within the last year with Kermit Gosnell. And for those unfamiliar, his house of horrors, he was a late-term abortionist that was convicted on 3 counts of first-degree murder in 2013, found guilty of involuntary manslaughter due to a botched abortion.
Yeah.
And his facility hadn't been inspected for over 17 years.
Mm-hmm. But do we have those problems in Iowa? Is that the rule? As you said, he was convicted. He was violating the current law.
Exactly. But how many women suffered for all of these years because there was no regulation and there was no standards? And we don't, here in Iowa, we have tried to pass legislation here in Iowa to make abortion facilities have the same requirements as ambulatory facilities, and those pieces of legislation have not gone through.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just talking again about if you go to a surgery center here in Iowa, why wouldn't you want to have those same basic requirements and making sure that your doctor has admitting privileges at the local hospital when you go to an abortion facility?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just makes sense. If you really, truly cared about women, you'd want to make sure that you are crossing all the T's, dotting all the I's, and making sure that everything is up to par and 100% the best that it could be.
Even though, as the court said, even procedures that are less safe than an abortion don't have the requirements you're talking about.
Well, I'm just talking about your basic surgery centers.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're comparing to. I mean, if you're going in to have a basic ambulatory surgical center, we're just saying let's have the same requirements, because why wouldn't we want women to be cared for by the same standards as surgery centers? And why wouldn't we want admitting privileges for those doctors?
Let me ask you this. Are you comfortable as an advocate against abortion being someone who is advocating for safer abortion?
I'm advocating for women. That's what I'm advocating for. And as a woman and as a mother of four children, I am advocating for women, for daughters, for children. That's what I'm advocating for. I, of course, do not want abortion. I want abortion unthinkable. I don't want abortion. There's no need for abortion in our country. But that being said, I don't want those women who are entering those facilities to go into unsafe and unsanitary and unregulated clinics.
Mm-hmm. What now with this Supreme Court ruling against the goals of Iowans for Life? What avenues are you pursuing as an organization?
You know, we're going to continue. We're going to continue this fight despite the setback. You know, we have a lot of things on our side. Science is on our side. Overwhelmingly, the young people are on our side. More and more youth and the millennials, they are coming out as pro-life. And we have so many things on our side, and we're just going to keep fighting and keep pursuing, keep educating people
mm-hmm.
of the dangers of abortion and keep educating that women deserve better.
Can you point to common ground that you would have with those who don't see your point of view?
I hope our common ground would be that we care about women. I hope our common ground would be that we want women to be safe, and that we want them to be in facilities that they are going to get the best care that they can get.
Maggie DeWitty, thank you for being with us today, Executive Director for Iowans for Life. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're getting a couple of Iowa perspectives in reaction to the U.S. Supreme Court issuing a historic defense of abortion rights. That was earlier this week on Monday. A 5-3 decision struck down parts of a Texas law that required clinics performing abortions to have surgical facilities. Not only that, but also required doctors who performed abortions to have admitting privileges to nearby hospitals. Let's now, for another perspective, talk with Mike Falkstrom. He's lead counsel for Planned Parenthood of the Heartland. Mike, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
Your reaction to this ruling, was it a surprise?
You know, I think it could have been unexpected. I mean, there's always a little, a little potential for some unexpected opinions, especially with the court only having 8 justices right now. But I can tell you, we were very pleased at the outcome and at the reasoning and the opinion.
Yeah. Tell us, what specifically, what words in the reasoning did you grab onto, did you hold onto and hold up?
Well, yeah, I think the court did a couple of things that were very, very important. One, the court made it clear that, you know, when they're looking at abortion restrictions, they're going to look at both the sort of loss of access that some of these restrictions can create, and then they're also, on the other hand, going to look to see if there are any benefits or if the benefits that the state is claiming are actually there, and they're going to look at the evidence. And that's exactly what the court did here. It's actually, some similar reasoning to the telemedicine opinion that came out of the Iowa Supreme Court earlier, where they really sort of are going to balance those factors against each other.
Mm-hmm. What is the significance of this U.S. Supreme Court ruling for Iowa, since Iowa does not have any of these laws, as Texas does?
Well, I think it is something that moving forward, policymakers are going to have to consider as they're looking at, any laws that are in front of them related to abortion. I think that, it indicates that the court is going to be very serious about making sure that you're not going to sort of pass these pretextual restrictions that, are sort of under the guise of patient safety, but don't really advance that, are really about limiting access.
I think you heard my conversation just a moment ago with Maggie DeWitty of Iowans for Life. What do you say to the concerns that she has about women's health? She used words like unsafe, unsanitary, unregulated.
Well, I think that it's important to understand that Planned Parenthood as a provider has some very rigorous medical standards that we adhere to and we audit consistently. I also think it's a little misleading to compare an abortion provider to an ambulatory surgical center. These are not the same thing. It's one of those things that gets tossed out there a lot because I think it could sound good to the public ear. But an ASC is really a different animal than an abortion provider is. We're talking about some more complex procedures. We're talking about procedures that could be provided with general anesthesia, which isn't the case in the abortion procedure. Whereas, as I think you mentioned earlier, other procedures, tonsillectomies, colonoscopies, that do have a higher risk than abortion does, aren't subject to those ASC standards. They're treated and regulated as sort of regular doctor's offices are through the different professional boards.
It's clear that the abortion debate, the controversy in this country will go on. What do you see as legal counsel for Planned Parenthood of the Heartland? Is there a part of the abortion debate that this ruling does settle once and for all?
I think it makes it clear that, we're not going to let policymakers anymore whose real motive is to restrict access, sort of hide behind this pretense of caring about patient safety, when, of course, their real goal is to limit access. I think the court has now said, we're going to put an end to that, and we're going to look much more closely at what these restrictions actually do.
Mm-hmm. The insinuation behind those who would oppose abortion, I think we heard in this interview and in others we've heard on this topic, is that they're the ones who care about women's health.
I'm not going to, sort of attack any statements about motives in terms of that, but what I can tell you is it is absolutely our priority to care about women's health and to care about a woman's ability to make her own decisions about her health. We provide our care under the highest standards. I think it's interesting to me, for instance, that in this case, these restrictions were opposed in court by groups from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the American Medical Association, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and other sort of leading professional medical groups. So, I think, claiming that there's, some sort of caring on one side and not the other is, I think, a little troubling.
Mm-hmm. Mike Falkstrom, thank you very much. Lead counsel for Planned Parenthood of the Heartland joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end our week. And I'm sure you heard this news if you were tuned into Iowa Public Radio. A black bear was killed on a highway in northeast Iowa in Allamakee County when it was struck by a truck. The Iowa Natural Resources Department says the bear weighed about 200 pounds. Big, but still, I think a young bear is the way they described it. Adam Jenke is with us, wildlife specialist for Iowa State University Extension. Hello, Adam.
Hi.
So how surprising was this news to you that there should be a black bear in Iowa?
In that part of the state particularly, I don't think we find it too surprising. We know that there's strong bear populations in bordering states here in Iowa and Minnesota and Wisconsin. relevant for the northeast corner of the state, and then a strong bear population in Missouri, too. So we do hear accounts on occasion. So,
Do you happen to know the last time a black bear was spotted here in Iowa?
There's sightings occasionally every year for the last few years. There was one actually found dead along a roadside last year, last spring. And so last year was, I think this was the first report from this year, at least the first report that I had heard.
What was he up to? What do you think was on his mind? What was he looking for?
Yeah. Well, you said in the introduction it was a male bear, and that's really common with mammals to, we call that a dispersal. They're essentially on the move. He was probably young, so his mother was having a litter, and she kicked him out, said to go find a new place to live, and he started to roam and found his way down to Iowa in search of probably food and probably a mate. Like I say, we see that really commonly. These young male mammals will make long moves in search of food and a mate.
Now, black bears are native to Iowa if we go back a few hundred years, right?
Yep. Go back to the 1800s. At the time of settlement, they were not really common in the way that they are in more wooded areas because Iowa was mostly prairie. But in the wooded areas, there were black bear accounts all across the state. I was reading an article this morning that said that they were found. There's a report, confirmed reportings of black bears in 48 counties in Iowa, and those span river to river, but they're mostly in the northeastern part of the state where the Mississippi River Valley provides a lot of wooded habitat that's really good for the bears.
It sounds like we have a safe guess that there used to be hundreds of black bears in Iowa.
Oh, certainly. Easily hundreds of black bears in breeding. And this is the 1800s at the time of settlement.
Yeah.
They would have found them. And then they declined through changes in the landscape, clearing of the land, and then exploitation, of course.
Do you have any information on if they were, I mean, we've changed so much of the habitat. Over 99% of Iowa's habitat is not what it used to be. And as you said, black bears prefer a forested area. Was it an intentional sort of extermination of the black bear in this state from what you've read, or just happened because we wanted to develop our agriculture?
I think the story, it's probably somewhere in between those two extremes, which is the case with a lot of wildlife. That we saw widespread extirpation in a lot of Midwestern states during settlement. We may be, an individual actor probably didn't know that they were, say, killing the last bear in Iowa or making the population so low that there would never be bears again, but people were acting in their own self-interest for either hunting or fur trapping or protecting livestock or crops, and eventually, basically death by a thousand cuts, we saw the bear population go so low that it was extirpated all the way up to where the only strongholds in really undeveloped lands in northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin.
Adam, have you ever encountered a black bear in the wild?
I have, in a couple of states, not, of course, in Iowa, but in some other states, yes.
So what was that encounter like? I mean, there's so much lore connected with bears, and that might frighten us. So I'm trying to say, what's the truth of the lore and what's the falsehoods in the lore there? What do they think of us humans and when we encounter them?
Well, like most wildlife, bears are as afraid, if not more afraid, of us than we are of them. And people live all over North America. People live in real close proximity to bears and have very few problems. So I personally wasn't afraid. And I think most people that see a bear, it's a pretty exciting thing. They're a really pretty creature and need to see them in their natural habitat. And so, like with all wildlife, we just say watch from a distance. Don't bother them, particularly if it's a sow with cubs, because she's obviously going to be protective. And they'll run away from you, and you'll have a nice memory, and maybe if you're lucky, have a nice photo to commemorate it.
Right, and we want to remind people that, I mean, what is the typical diet of a black bear? They're looking for berries and roots and so forth?
Yep, yeah, they're a lot like humans, really. They're a classic omnivore. They eat just about anything, and a high percentage, over 80% of their diet tends to be plant material. So like you said, roots, berries, vegetation, things like that. They do eat animal material too, just like we do. They'll eat a lot of insects, actually, which is funny, that big 200-pound creature catching crickets. But they'll also eat some smaller mammals as well, and they'll even feed on, they'll scavenge on what we call carrion, or just dead material they encounter along the road or somewhere else out in the wild.
Mm-hmm. What are some other native species native to Iowa that are just not here anymore that we pushed out at about the same time, I imagine?
Yeah. Well, we pushed a lot out, and thanks to the strong efforts of a lot of conservation-minded folks, including the DNR and others, we brought a lot back. But those that kind of remain unfinished business, if you will, that were there at the time of settlement and we've extirpated and haven't gotten back, like bears would include, elk would be an example. There were a lot of elk in Iowa historically. Other large carnivores like gray wolves and mountain lions historically would have been found in Iowa and aren't anymore. Antelope in the western part of the state. And some of those we'll probably never see come back. Some of the conservation success stories, the species we did see come back, like river otters and white-tailed deer and wild turkeys, are a thrill for a lot of Iowans. And I don't know where bears will fall on that spectrum.
So we've had a successful reintroduction of river otters. River otters were at one time not found anymore in Iowa?
We're pretty sure they were almost completely extirpated, but they might have they probably held on. We periodically would have had them along the Mississippi River and along the Missouri River coming up from established populations, but now they're statewide. They could be in every county, and they've been documented in almost every county. And that was thanks to the efforts of a reintroduction program through the DNR and then just natural colonization out from those reintroductions.
Right. And, of course, a real shining example is our bald eagle population, which is phenomenal. Coming to work one day a couple years ago, I spotted from my bike on a tree eight of them next to the river. I was amazed because we were down to how many mating pairs in the 70s?
I don't know the number off the top of my head, but it wasn't very many.
Yeah.
And you're right, they are an icon of what an organized effort for conservation can do for a species. And I think everybody enjoys to see bald eagles, and they sure are pretty conspicuous now.
Yeah. We've got about a minute left. Back to black bears. You say many communities across the United States live in close proximity to black bear populations and don't really have any problem. But black bears in Iowa would have to be protected, wouldn't they? They aren't protected by law, right?
That's right. The story of black bears in Iowa is pretty interesting because by the time in the 1800s, by the time we got around to protecting wildlife, we didn't have to talk about black bears anymore because they were already gone. And so they never made it onto a list of protected or managed species by the state. And then, of course, they're not protected federally. And so, there are no protections for black bears in Iowa right now. And that will be a decision that the people of Iowa essentially have to make as we start to see more bears colonizing southern Wisconsin and southern Minnesota.
Okay. Adam Jenke, thank you very much. Wildlife specialist for Iowa State University Extension. Thank you for your wealth of information about black bears and other once native species here in Iowa.
Yes, thank you. Have a good day.
You too. When we come back, you hear it. This is Gustav Holst. Playing a Jupiter suite, I think it's called. We'll talk with Bill Kurth when we come back. University of Iowa scientist, co-investigator for a radio and plasma wave experiment aboard the NASA-led Juno mission in just a few days. This mission will begin its orbit of Jupiter. We'll be back with talk with Bill Kurth. It's River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come this hour, a little bit later, after 6 dry years, Lake Delhi begins to refill. That in just a few moments. But first, this. It's been a nearly 5-year journey to our solar system's largest planet. On the 4th of July, the NASA-led Juno mission will maneuver into orbit around Jupiter. After being launched in August of 2011, Juno has traveled over, get this, 1,700 million miles to reach the immense planet. Aboard the spacecraft, a a radio and plasma wave experiment devised by a team at the University of Iowa. Joining us now from the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California, Bill Kurth, University of Iowa scientist and lead co-investigator for this radio and plasma wave experiment aboard Juno. Bill Kurth, what a pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
So, describe what will happen in a few days on July 4th.
Well, at approximately the same time Iowans are watching the fireworks displays in Iowa, starting at 10:18 Iowa time, Juno will fire its main engine to slow down and to be captured into Jupiter's gravitational field. And that will put it in orbit. It will take 35 minutes for that burn to occur. So by 10:53 p.m. Iowa time, Juno should be safely in orbit around Jupiter.
Okay, how far away from Jupiter in orbit? Can you tell us that?
At the closest approach, we're a little under 3,000 miles from the tops of the clouds. This is the closest any spacecraft has come to Jupiter. We'll be moving very fast at that point. Eventually, we'll get into an orbit that is 14 days long that is highly eccentric. Its closest approach to Jupiter will be 2,500, 3,000 miles or so. And at the farthest part of its orbit, it will be about 45 times Jupiter's planetary radius. It's a little bit easier to think about how far that is.
So I'm trying to picture this. 14 days to have an elliptical orbit around Jupiter.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when that happens on July 4th, how risky is that procedure when those engines are fired and you put it into orbit?
Well, we'll all breathe a sigh of relief when it's all said and done, but there's been literally years and years of effort thinking about all the things that have to work properly, thinking about all the things that could go wrong, and basically programming the spacecraft to know how to take care of itself, to execute the burn flawlessly. It's been tested on the ground many times. There have been two maneuvers similar to the JOI burn a couple of years into the orbit. We took a long looping orbit around the solar system past the orbit of Mars and did two what we call deep space maneuvers that retargeted the spacecraft to do a close flyby at Earth. And those engine maneuvers were done exactly the same way that the one on July 4th will be done. So we have every confidence that everything will go the way it's supposed to.
And up to this point in its nearly five-year mission after launching from Earth, as far as we know, Juno is happy, healthy, and communicating with all of you at the Jet Propulsion Lab.
Yes, that's true.
Mm-hmm. So tell us, what will the instrument that you and the team at the University of Iowa do once Juno is in this closest orbit ever of Jupiter?
The Iowa instrument measures naturally occurring waves in plasmas and in space. It covers the frequency range from 50 hertz, which is near the bottom end of the audio frequency range, all the way up to 40 megahertz, which is kind of the top end of one class of Jovian radio emissions that are generated along with the same process that creates the auroras on Jupiter. And so we'll monitor these, and the most exciting part of this process is that we'll actually fly directly above the auroras as they're being created, and we'll be able to understand whether plasma waves help accelerate the charged particles that crash into the atmosphere to cause it to glow. We'll actually fly through the source of these very intense radio emissions. Jupiter is the most intense radio source in the solar system other than the sun. So for the first time, we'll actually get to fly directly through that region and try to understand the physics of how it works, be able to compare it with how the auroras at Earth work, and see if our understanding extends to the very extreme environment at Jupiter with its magnetic field that's 20,000 times the intensity of the Earth's magnetic field.
Mm-hmm. So, I wanted to ask about that because to compare Jupiter's atmosphere and Earth's atmosphere, they're completely different, it sounds like?
They're completely different. Well, first of all, recall that Jupiter is the largest planet in the solar system. In fact, not counting the sun, it comprises 70% of the mass in the solar system. So you can take all the other planets combined and asteroids and comets, and they don't include as much mass as Jupiter does. So it's the biggest planet. Its day is 9 hours and 55 minutes long, so it's a very rapid rotator. It has this very strong magnetic field. And another thing that I think is very exciting about Jupiter is it has a little moon not too far from it called Io. Io happens to be the most volcanically active body in the solar system. At any one time, it's got 8 or 9 volcanoes going off.
Amazing.
And this little moon spews a ton of material per second into the magnetized bubble around Jupiter. We call its magnetosphere. And so between the rapidly rotating, very strong magnetic field and this source of plasma, the source of material that's deep within Jupiter's magnetosphere, we have a very exciting combination of energy and mass and all sorts of things going on that we're anxious to study.
Mm-hmm. So what will the Juno mission, the instrument that you and your team devise, as well as the other instruments aboard, what are they likely to tell us about Jupiter, its atmosphere, that we don't already know?
Well, I should say a little bit about the rest of the payload of Juno, because while I've talked about the auroras and the magnetosphere of Jupiter, Juno is actually also going to tell us a lot about the very deep interior of Jupiter, with the intent of telling us about the origin of Jupiter and how it evolved. If you want to understand the evolution of the planets in the solar system or the planets in another solar system, not necessarily ours, you really have to understand how Jupiter formed because, as I said, it comprises most of the mass of the solar system after the sun was created. We don't know how much water is in the atmosphere, for example. It turns out that the Galileo probe was dropped into a very dry spot in the atmosphere, and it looks like it doesn't have very much water, but that was a one-point measurement, and we don't know if it's indicative of the rest of the planet. We'll measure how much water is in Jupiter's atmosphere. If there's a lot of water, it may tell us that Jupiter formed further from the sun than it did. It may have formed from blocks of ice that gravitationally collected together. If it doesn't have as much water, it might be that Jupiter formed in a totally different way. Juno will also measure the gravity field of Jupiter very accurately and tell us about the possible existence of a core at the center of the planet. We think there probably is one. We don't know how large it is. And how large that core is also tells us something about how Jupiter formed, whether it was just a collection of gas and dust or whether it started from some rocky material that then collected other materials around it.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I'm just wondering, in your explanation there, your description, I wonder, does Jupiter have a surface as we think of it?
No, it does not, unless perhaps it has a core, and that core perhaps has a surface. But I won't go there.
It's an unknown, is what you're saying.
Right, but Jupiter is what we call a gas giant. It's primarily composed of hydrogen and helium, And so it really does not have a surface like anything that we at Earth would be familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
You could fall into the planet and just keep going all the way in.
Amazing. Do I remember correctly from, I don't know, junior high, high school, that were Jupiter to be a bit bigger, it could have been a mini sun?
Yes. I think it's, I can't tell you how much bigger it would have to be, but there are stars in the galaxy that we call brown dwarfs that are a little bit bigger than Jupiter, but actually became stars, but just barely. Jupiter's not that large, but it's actually a class of planet that has been seen. These exoplanets that have been observed, many of them are called Jupiter-like planets because they have kind of the mass and the size of Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of what we would call the end member of a planetary system, a very large planet, and it's the other end members are, as you might imagine, planets like Mercury and maybe even Pluto and asteroids if you want to go to smaller bodies.
Mm-hmm. This Juno mission started nearly 5 years ago. Of course, the planning and the creation of the craft and your experiment started long before that. The mission has a $1.13 billion price tag. Are we getting our money's worth?
I think so. That's not for me to say. This is, you know, the NASA budget is less than 1% of the federal budget, and the total cost of the Juno mission, if you paid for it all in 1 year, is probably 5% of 1 year of NASA's budget. So this is really a very tiny fraction of a percent of NASA's budget. You can talk about what's the importance of doing scientific discovery. I have a colleague who works in Israel studying Jupiter's magnetosphere. He was once asked at dinner, "Arky, you live in a country that's surrounded on all sides by enemies, yet your government sees fit to provide you funding to study the magnetosphere of Jupiter. How can that be?" And his answer was very simple. He said, "My government believes that without culture, without the arts, and without the sciences, our military has nothing to defend."
I like that answer. Juno's mission comes to a critical point here when it will start orbiting on July 4th. How long will the mission last after that? How will it end?
Well, the current plan is for the mission to end on February 20th, 2018, by basically targeting the spacecraft to crash into the planet. That's required by That's required by international agreement that we should not contaminate bodies in the solar system that may have or may in the may actually now harbor life. It's called planetary protection.
We think Jupiter might have life?
Not Jupiter itself, but one of its moons, Europa, to which NASA is currently working on a mission to study in detail, has an icy crust over what we believe is a large water ocean. And in fact, some estimates are that Europa has more water in its ocean than all the oceans on Earth combined.
Whoa.
And so if you think about where you might go elsewhere in the solar system to look for evidence of life, Europa is one of the places on the top of everybody's list to go look. Can we get through the ice? Can we see if there's actually life in that ocean? Now imagine what would happen if we arrive there 20 or 30 years from now and had a way of examining Europa closely for microbes or some evidence of life. And in 2018, Juno had happened to crash into that moon, carrying who knows what kind of microbes that it collected before it was launched from Earth. Mm. Then we'd be always asking the question, okay, is the life that was found on Europa, did it actually come to Europa from Earth on Juno? So that's really the purpose of disposing of the spacecraft in Jupiter itself, because no one expects there to be life at Jupiter. If we make sure that it ends up in Jupiter, then we know that it's not going to happen to run into Europa at all.
Mm. Bill Kurth, I could talk with you, listen to you for hours. We have a limited amount of time, so we're going to say goodbye. Bill Kurth, University of Iowa scientist and lead co-investigator for a radio and plasma wave experiment that's aboard the NASA-led Juno mission. It's been on its way to Jupiter for nearly 5 years, and on July 4th, as Bill just said, about the time we're watching fireworks, it will fire rockets and go into orbit. We'll cross our fingers, Bill, and at that point, you'll probably raise a glass to the 4th of July and to the successful orbiting of Juno.
We certainly will.
Okay. We'll check back in with you. Thank you very much, Bill Kurth of the University of Iowa.
Thank you.
And finally on this News Buzz edition of River to River, 6 years ago, the dam at the lake at Lake Delhi, that's in northeast Iowa, broke. It drained the lake very quickly. This summer, it's set to reopen, and right now residents are anxiously awaiting rain to refill the lake behind a newly constructed dam. Steve Leonard is with me now, president of the Lake Delhi Combined Recreational and Water Quality District. Hi, Steve.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. I understand you've been working for about a half decade to refill the lake. Remind us, before we get to where we are in the present, what happened on that day about 6 years ago?
Yeah, about 6 years ago, we had supercells in our area that gave us about 12 inches of rain in a 24-hour period of time that was record-level waters in our watershed, and that was just enough to put us over the top as it relates to the amount of water flow that our dam could safely pass in terms of passage. We had the capability for about 30,000 cubic feet per second with a dam that was built back in the 1920s, and the earthen portion of our dam was overtopped, and to your point, things drained very quickly 6 years ago.
And this is
a lot of hopes and dreams went along with it.
Right. This is not a small body of water. 9 miles long, 450 acres worth of water, whoosh, went away all at once. So what's happening with the lake right now? Is it getting a refill?
Yeah. So a week ago today, I'm very proud to say so much work and effort by so many came to a great day last Friday, where we were able to close the gates on our new concrete dam structure and spillway structure, except for allowing for the minimum amount allowed to keep the water stream alive, fish alive downstream from that. So we've been storing water. Unfortunately, rain has not hit us. It's bypassed all these storms in the last week or so, have missed us either to the north or the south. So We're slowly rising, but we need a good rain to get the job done.
Well, I'm sure it'll hit you at some point. So how much did this cost? This is a privately fundraised thing.
Well, it was privately and publicly fundraised. So our local residents, along with the local community, raised about half of the project cost, which is a total cost of about $16 million. The other half came from state and county funds to enable the rebuilding of this public lake.
Mm-hmm. For those not familiar with the Lake Delhi area, it's quite a special community. Tell us, we've got about a minute left. Tell us about the community and the community's hopes for being revived by the returning lake.
Yeah, so given the size with all the different property owners and all the businesses and the communities surrounding, like Manchester, Delhi, Hopkinton, and a whole bunch of others around that area, we're right in the middle of Dubuque, Waterloo, Cedar Falls, and Cedar Rapids. So it's a huge tourist area for eastern Iowa to come to. So when we are back here in just hopefully a matter of days and weeks, not only will we have fishing, we'll have jet skiing, we'll have water skiing capabilities, and in the winter we'll have a lot of ice fishing and snowmobiling on the lake as it's frozen. So this cherished area has been out of commission now for about 6 years, and we are so happy to have a great big grand opening celebration coming up on July 23rd and 24th, which marks the exact date that we got that storm.
Okay, let's hope for some rain to refill Lake Dale High before your grand opening. That would be a shame if we didn't, wouldn't it, Steve?
Yeah, I would hate to have to extend it out a few weeks, but, you know, if it is what it is, Mother Nature's going to dictate when we're full, but
okay.
We hope to have it all full, ready to go.
Okay, get out there and do a rain dance, Steve.
Exactly.
All right. Steve Leonard, the president of the Lake Dale High Combined Recreational and Water Quality District. They're talking about the refilling of Lake Dale High. That does it for this edition of River to River, produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth, with help from Graham Bly. Our executive producer of talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. On Monday at this time, because it's the 4th of July, we'll have the Capitol Steps. I'm looking forward to that at this time. Capitol Steps, Politics Takes a Holiday. Tune in for that over the noon hour on Monday. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.